The Offside Rule, We Get It, with Hayley McQueen and Kate Borsay.
A very warm welcome. It's another week, it's another Offside Rule podcast, episode 21, and we're in fine fickle today, ladies and gentlemen, without Lindsay Hooper, but instead with Soccer AM's Lisa O'Grady. So before we go any further, let's say a quick hello to Spurs fan Lisa. Have you cleaned up the beans from the Soccer AM dance-off yet, Lisa?
Yeah, just about. I think there's a few still stuck in the bottom of my shoe, but yeah, we're getting there.
Who won your prize, Hayley McQueen, who joins us as well today?
I think just everybody for effort did pretty well. I think probably Lisa for actually managing to, as Ray Wilkins would say, stay on her feet in those high heels, dancing in that manner with just stuff covering the floor and not managing to actually fall flat on her face. I think that in itself deserves an award. A police report, or there are no injuries, are there, off the back of that?
Anyway, let's get back to the podcast. Don't forget you can listen to us. We're out every Thursday on Audioboo and on iTunes. You can find us on Twitter at Offside Rule Pod, and our website is offsiderulepodcast.com. Now, what delights have we got in store for you this week? Well, a little bit later on, we're going to be talking going left field. Jermaine Defoe is going to be leaving England and heading over to the MLS and to Canadian side Toronto FC. There's a bit of a choice reason, apparently, why he decided to join that club. We'll be discussing more of that later on, as well as talking about other bizarre transfer moves, or transfer moves for bizarre reasons, anyway. Coming up right near the end of the show, sometimes you just want the ground to swallow you up. Now, if you've ever been out clubbing with me, you'll understand what that means. Jason Puncheon's epic penalty miss for Palace at the weekend. It was a howler. Other moments of huge embarrassment when you just wanted the ground to swallow you up. But shortly, we'll move on to topic one. Stay tuned, folks.
The female take on football.
Well, there was all sorts that went on in the Premier League this weekend. An unconscious Guy Demel for West Ham. Thank goodness he's all right now. A profanity-spouting Alan Pardew. A hat-trick. Yes, you heard me right. A hat-trick for Adam Johnson. Wins for all the top sides, including your side, Hayley McQueen. I'm sure you're very relieved here today. And it's amazing, isn't it, actually, that when you get to rest a full complement of a squad, or when you rest some of the bigger squads, just how they come into their own and start winning after that busy Christmas period. And outside of the Premier League, the Ballon d'Or won by Cristiano Ronaldo, as many expected. The female award was given to German Nadine Angerer, who decided to collect her award wearing rather a cool hat, which I thought was a nice move. I am the German, I can wear my hat, it's okay, I just collect my award wearing the hat, I don't care if it's a sign of disrespect, I wear my hat. Well done to her. So that's what's been happening this week. Let's take a look at our first subject, because one of the many discussion points this week is that bottom half of the Premier League table. There are 7 points that separate Southampton in ninth and Hull in tenth. The bottom half of the table, ladies, is defined by only 6 points from 10th to 20th. It's literally anyone's guess. I've asked each of you ladies to pick your three clubs for Premier League relegation and two or three lines per club on why. Lisa, I'm going to break with form, Hayley McQueen, and go to Lisa O'Grady.
Okay, well, obviously, I find this quite a hard topic to talk about, basically, because I'm used to spending my day pointing out people slipping over as opposed to slipping in the table. But first up, pretty predictable. There's always a team that tends to head straight back to where they came from. So first of all, I'm going with Crystal Palace. Now, they've only won one of their last six games, drawn one, lost four. Tony Pulis has won 10 points in his 9 games in charge, and they won 7 points from their opening 12 games. They're the lowest scorers in the Premier League, scored 13 goals, and they've scored 2 goals in their last 5 games.
OK, so you've gone for Palace, not one that I've chosen, I have to say. But you have, Hayley.
Yeah, I have, actually. I think Pulis is a great manager. I just don't think they've got the squad. Joel Ward, they've been key to the side defensively, but they just completely lack firepower. They have had Shamak, they have got Gale, but they've only just recently kind of found their goal-scoring form. I just don't think they can cut it against the big boys.
I think the mood's changed. I detected when I was there, in and around the training ground, quite a bit of optimism. I like the team spirit. I like the way that Tony Pulis operates. He is a coach. You know, he doesn't like the office tactics thing. He likes getting out there on the field and doing it with the players. Lisa, let's go with your next one.
Okay, next is Fulham. I personally don't want to see them go down, but unfortunately the stats just don't lie. They've lost 10 of their last 13 Premier League games, all 3 wins in the last 7 games. They've conceded 46 goals in the Premier League this season. That's like the worst defence, you know, so far. And 20 goals in the last six games. So the team that faced Sunderland on Saturday had an average age of 30 years and 256 days. So if they are going to stay up, then they need to sign some players that are going to input some energy into the squad.
I interviewed Aaron Hughes at Fulham actually recently, and he is one of those very experienced players, and that's why I've said that they're not going to go down. Although I don't think René Meulensteijn will stay, because he's not one of those managers who wants to park the bus. Someone in the press conference actually said to him, look, are you not just going to, whenever you go up, just park the bus and kind of hang on to these valuable wins? And he was like, no, not at all. I will not digress away from the attacking play and from our attacking mindedness. And I worry for him. But with Alan Kerbishley there now and Ray Wilkins too, I think what will happen is Meulensteijn will either step aside or go. And I know there's been a lot of change there, but with Kerbishley and Wilkins and the experience in the side, I know that that defence has got all awful. I mean, it, you know, really, it's such a terrible amount of goals let in that. But I think with those two and the experience, that's going to keep them up. Have you gone for Fulham as well, Hayley, to go down?
Oh,
okay. Well, let's get Lisa's third before we move on to yours.
Oh, I feel really bad. It's Norwich or Cardiff, and I think I'm going to have to go with Cardiff. And those reasons are because they've dropped into the bottom three for the first time this season after their 2-0 defeat to West Ham. They've lost four of their last five, and they've only won one of their last 11. They've scored only 15 goals in 21 Premier League games this season, and only Crystal Palace have scored fewer with 13. So, yeah, for that reason, I'm going to have to go with Cardiff.
Well, I agree with you, Lisa. Inexperience in the league, one of my reasons. Vincent Tan, their owner, says he's got said he had no money to spend, but he still managed to find the cash to sign a player with Wolf in his name, the second Wolf in the Premier League after Ricky van Wolfswinkel. Can we ever have enough Wolves in the Premier League would be my point there. They're linked to quite a few loan signings. Solskjaer now in charge there, the man-child himself, or is it Doogie Howser? I don't know. I get confused with him. Very successful at Molder. He's worshipped in Norway, and you'll find that at Molder he would have attracted the cream of the talent. You know, these are boys, players who would have worshipped Solskjaer when they were growing up, so he had the pick of it. I think he's going to find the Premier League tough. I think he could have chosen himself a different job, a better job for him, with a less erratic owner. Right, Lisa, so we've had your three. Hayley, we've got two more to get from you.
Well, I haven't gone for Cardiff because I am a big fan of Ollie, and Vincent Tan, I know, because he's turning Cardiff red, does love Manchester United, and I think he'll make sure that he gives this man, who he considers a legend, as many others do as well, the money that he needs. I think just going to keep the faith, and I think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is not a man who's used to losing anything, really. So I think maybe at the last minute, in true Ole style, they will stay up. Sunderland, however, I feel are going to go straight down. Too much change. They survive by the skin of their teeth. They just don't excite me as a side either. The team is just a mishmash of too many managers with an input. Too much has gone on at the club with upset of the players. I think nobody knows quite where they stand. Yes, they have Gouzpoy, but I think it's a task too great for him. Don't think it's going to have much money to spend either. When you look at their last few games, they have Chelsea and Manchester United right at the end of the season, and Cardiff too. So that's for me. The other one, I've gone for Norwich actually. It was between Norwich and West Ham, and this was a difficult one. They had that summer splurge with the Wolfsman, Hooper and Almander as well. Only took till recently for them to all actually start scoring. Up until mid-November, they had just six shots on target between them. I mean, that is absolutely woeful. I love Chris Hughton. He's my friend's dad. So just for her and for the family, I would like them to stay up. But realistically, I don't think they have the unity of last season. They had a really recognised steady starting 11 last season. Too much change, no consistency. He's sticking with a 4-1-4-1. You're not getting the same players week in, week out, which they can do because they're not involved in other competition in the Europa League and things like that. There's not enough Premier League experience. With the new players they signed, they haven't got experienced Premier League heads who have ever dealt with a relegation battle before. They've had heavy defeats, embarrassing defeats. City 7-0, United they let in 4, Liverpool put 5 past them. Yes, they are capable of pulling out a shock result. Manchester United, they only conceded 1 against them, but it was a one-off and that gave them hope, but I think that is the only hope they have. West Ham, it will all depend on January. Andy Carroll will be back. I predict him to have a good end of season. He is absolutely desperate to prove so many people wrong. I feel really sorry for him. I think Sam does have the backing of the board. They've got money. I think they're going to stay safe. One thing that I was deciding on between West Ham and Norwich, I thought, it's the Roger Johnson jinx. Roger Johnson has been relegated three times in his career. And I thought, oh, actually, if he carries that jinx, and he had a terrible first game as well. He's had a terrible time, hasn't he? But they're the only side in the current bottom five to have retained the manager since the start of the season. So that consistency could possibly be the key.
Well, I have not thought like that, Hayley, and I've gone for West Ham to go down, I'm afraid. They won at the weekend, but the manner of those FA Cup and League Cup defeats saw them look like a side who weren't fighting for every game. They just really didn't look like they were in it at all. Now, maybe that's the point. Maybe they're saving their energy for the league, but don't underestimate what dented pride might do to lifelong West Ham fans David Gold and David Sullivan. Now, I do admire Sam Allardyce as a manager, but he hasn't got the squad, and there's an on-the-pitch discipline problem. How many Reds of West Ham picked up three in total? In fact, four, sorry. Mark Noble earlier on in the season, Kevin Nolan, two red cards within four games. That's really injured the team, and he's the captain. He's the one who should be setting the example. And then James Tomkins as well at the weekend too. So I think West Ham are trying to attack relegation in the wrong way with discipline issues and with fighting gung-ho for everything, which I do admire, but it's got to be done in the right way, isn't it? I think Allardyce will go before the end of the season. That coupled with a new manager trying to get to grips with things and a squad who already seem to be at sixes and sevens. Too much pressure on Andy Carroll. He went to Liverpool, massive move to Liverpool. How did he do under pressure there? He didn't do well at all. I can't see that West Ham needing him to get so many goals. I can't see that he's going to enjoy that pressure either. So I think West Ham are going to go down quicker than a participant of one of David Sullivan's blue movies. Right, so my other tip is Sunderland. I agree with you, Hayley, on Sunderland. Bottom at Christmas. History tells you that apart from West Brom in 2005, the bottom club at Christmas goes down. I don't see any different for this season. Too much unrest at the club with the arrival and the departure of Paolo Di Canio. He was good in the short term, but I think he really damaged that side. Too much stacked against Gus Poyet. I don't think he's experienced enough within the league. I don't think he was the natural appointment for Sunderland. I didn't agree with the Di Canio signing either. So I have to question Sunderland's managers, really. Their current form, actually pretty good. Only one defeat in six in the league. But I think they're going to slump again. I think that they've basically driven up to Christmas, attacked it full on. They've had a pretty good record recently, but I think that their form is going to dip again. And I don't think they've got the mental strength to win out. So I hope that's not too depressing a start to the podcast. But just to recap, Lisa has gone for Cardiff, for Fulham and for Palace to go down. Hayley has also chosen Palace and she's gone for Sunderland and Norwich as well. And I went for Cardiff, for West Ham and for Sunderland, like Hayley McQueen.
Hi, I'm Matt Letitier and you're listening to The Offside Rule. Three girls talking about football.
OK, let's move on to topic two, going left field. That topic one, by the way, was called tight bottoms. I hope you appreciated that, yeah. Jermaine Defoe completed his move to the MLS and to Toronto FC. Apparently, he was persuaded to go there in part by rapper Drake. Who this rapper is, I have no idea. So apparently persuaded to go there in part by this Canadian rapper Drake. Name two other transfer moves, ladies. Any league, any country that have happened for slightly odd reasons or in strange circumstances. Hayley, I'm going to go to you first.
What about a man who blatantly went and signed for a club purely for the money? It's all about the money, money, money. Samuel Eto'o was one of the greatest strikers in the world at one point. And he's playing in Russia. Yeah, that's right. He travelled to Machakala, flying around 1,250 miles 15 times a season during his time there whilst playing football. That's what you're going to be doing to your body because it is a very big country. £8.7 million is what he will come out with in his deal going and playing there. I just think it's a bit of a shame that you have somebody like him, a world-class player, going over there and playing. And the reason he'll be travelling so much is because obviously Russia's a very big country, travelling around, but the training camp and where they play isn't safe enough, so they do basically train over 1,000 miles away from where their home games will be played, which is, I think, is just all a little bit crazy. It's a real shame that he couldn't have come and stayed in the Premier League or gone somewhere else in world football to a respected club. No disrespect to Russia. They have some great teams in the league, but I think he went for all the wrong reasons. Maybe it'd be better if he'd gone there and ended his career in Russia, like a 34-year-old, 35-year-old player might do, just to go and get a bit of money at the end. But in the middle of a really great career, okay, yes, he's obviously gone on and played top flight football since then and returned, and he's done some great things at Chelsea. However, I think going to Russia in the first place and trying himself out there is just all a little bit weird.
The fact he's now playing for Chelsea is not because he fancied coming back to the Premier League. It's because Angie ran out of money. So that says everything, doesn't it?
Harry Kewell is my other choice. Another one who I think made decisions not from his heart or his head, but from the bank account of his agent, who, of course, he left Leeds in pretty controversial circumstances. And he was absolutely loved there. And I think he could have gone on to have a great career and could have gone on to have a great career with Liverpool as well. Of course, he chose to go and play in Turkey. He thought it was an up-and-coming league and he decided to go there, which is pretty much to do with, again, I think, in my opinion, his wages. But why not stay over here? Why not play for Liverpool? Why not have stuck it out at Leeds United? Okay, Leeds back then, when he played, were actually a much bigger side than they are obviously now. If you're listening and you're one of the youngsters thinking, you what? She's talking about Leeds United. They were the mighty Leeds United. But he could have had a really great career over in England, but he's chosen some really strange moves. He has gone out to obviously play out in Australia as well. I just think it's a real shame that somebody has decided to go abroad and not go and play in sort of La Liga Serie A or the Bundesliga or maybe the French League because you want a bit of culture and to go abroad. He's chosen leagues where he's basically been told he'll get a ridiculous amount of money to go and play, and it's almost sacrificed his career and I think his respect from people as well. But young players, don't look to Harry Kewell. Maybe look up to people like Gary Neville and Paul Scholes and all the United legends who've done their own deals without agents and not fleece the clubs for all the money. There you go.
That's right. Wheel out the examples of the United players. Why don't you? There's no favouritism on this podcast, Lisa. Lisa, strange, bizarre transfer moves. Give us a couple of yours.
Okay, well, my first one has a slight Soccer AM connection to it, a bit of a random one. But in 1983, Luther Blissett moved from Watford to AC Milan. Now, obviously, a lot of people were quite surprised by this move. He transferred for £1 million, which in that day, that kind of money could buy you pretty much anyone. Now, rumour had it that reports had actually been sent back on the wrong player. And that's why he headed out there. But sadly, after only scoring 5 goals in 30 appearances, he sadly headed back to Vicarage Road the following season, which was probably a good thing because apparently he missed Rice Krispies. And for those that don't know, obviously the fan stand in the Soccer AM studio is named after Luther Blissett, after he kindly sorted out some of the crew some tickets when they were stuck. My second one, I'm going for Edgar Davids to Barnet. Now, obviously, he enjoyed a glittering career across the world, playing for the likes of Ajax, AC Milan, Juventus, Barcelona, Inter Milan, and of course the mighty Spurs. Can't forget them.
Of course.
Even towards the end of his career, he stepped out for Crystal Palace and he claimed that apparently playing for the South London side was in fact one of the greatest experiences of his life. What a nice guy. If that wasn't bizarre enough, in 2012, after 2 years out of the game, he signed on with no salary for, at the time, bottom side of League Two, Barnet, stating they were his local club.
I suppose when he was a Spurs player, forget the fact that he was playing for Spurs, of course. Were Barnet his local club, possibly? Who knows? Very strange indeed. And it continues to be strange as well, doesn't it? A couple from me here. Clark Carlisle. Now, his move to York City came about because of Soccer AM. Good one for Lisa here. He was released by Burnley in May 2012. And he'd made the first of his documentaries by then, and it had been really well received. And I think he was subject, and I think he'd admit this, I've spoken to him about it since, that he was almost taken in or sort of promised too much by the now flaky media bunch around him, or just flaky media people in general. I'm sure we've all met a few of them, ladies, who are like, you need to do this for a living, you'll have a really good career after football. And he felt it was the right time for him to retire and hang up his boots. So his career at Burnley came to an end, and I honestly think he did intend to go into media work. And when there wasn't enough media work and bills had to be paid, and you can read about this in his really good book, actually. That's not a massive plug for it. It is a good book. He had to go onto Soccer AM and basically appeal for a new club. And it happened, if not on the last day of the transfer window, the sort of second to last day, York City came in for him. He then went from York to Northampton again. But, you know, essentially he had to go and get his transfer move courtesy of Soccer AM. The next transfer move is one that was instigated by a player for foul play, basically. Yann M'Vier, the French international, was part of the setup back there for the under-21 Euros. And in their qualifying stages, they were due to play Norway. It was the second leg. And very unwisely, he and four teammates decided that they wanted to have a night out just days before this all-important tie, and qualification to the under-21 European Championships depended upon victory. So what did Yann M'Vier and four of his wise French buddies decide to do? They decided to have a night out on the town, not just locally near their base. They decided to travel 200 kilometres. So that would be like us going to Birmingham for a night out a few days before a game. They decided to go 200 kilometres in a taxi to have a night out. They were found out, of course they were, and he was banned for 20 months, which means that he now misses any chance of making the World Cup this year. So his own stupidity led to that. He decided to accept a move to Rubin Kazan in Russia, basically to try and stay out of trouble, because he admitted what he'd done in his personal life had caused him to want to get out of it. Now, quite how going to Rubin Kazan in Russia with lots of lovely ladies and lots of prime vodka will quite get him out of that situation, I don't know. I'm sure he's having a very nice time over there, and let's hope that he comes back or enters back into European football older. Well, he'll definitely be older and wiser. Time to head over to Sean Thorne for our Twitter topic of the week. And our topic three is connected to this. But here's Sean Thorne to tell you a bit more about it.
Twitter topic of the week.
So one of the big talking points from this weekend was Jason Puncheon's Johnny Wilkinson-esque penalty miss for Palace. Now, you know penalties are bad when you get 3 or 4 days worth of news out of it. Even old Neil Warnock weighed in with his two penneth. So we decided to ask you guys for your suggestions of the worst penalty misses of all time. And we got absolutely loads of stuff from this. Thanks loads to everyone who sent us a suggestion or a video. So first off, I've seen this penalty described as a waltz that turned into a hokey-cokey, a fiasco, a classic, a spectacular blunder. It is, of course, the sham that was Henry and Pires' attempt to be a bit cute with a penalty against Manchester City, and they just ended up looking like a right pair of mugs. Thanks to Paul, Mike Trevelyan, London Phoenix FC, Sam Stafford and Philip Gatt, who all gave that one a shout. Now, I wasn't familiar with the work of Peter Devine until Neil George Coleman and Alice Barber Rogers sent me a video of his penalty effort. Now, if I had to describe it, I'd go for tragic. It was so bad, it almost blasts through the borders of hilarity into the realms of pity. Poor old Peter. Now, Daryl and Leo went for Terry's slip in the Champions League final against United. I mean, there's a time and a place to nose up a penalty. But as usually, in the recesses of your very worst of your worst nightmares, to miss a penalty while captaining your side in the Champions League final against a rival. Unlucky there, John Boy. VJ Gunner, Dion and Craig also went for the penalty, which was probably winning in the heartbreak stakes as well. Beckham's penalty disaster in Euro 2004. Oh, horrific stuff. Still sends chills down my spine just even thinking about it now. Adrian went with my personal choice, Jan Kermigan's penalty miss for Leicester in the playoff against Cardiff. Now, YouTube Kermigan and find the resulting song in that penalty's honour. That's brilliant stuff. You won't regret looking for that. Now, we've had so many of these, we're going to stick a load of them on the website as well. So you can have a little look at them on there, offsiderulepodcast.com. And it's had a little bit of a makeover as well. It looks very, very slick. But for now, I've been Sean Thorne, and I will hand you back to the girls.
Do check out our website as well, folks, offsiderulepodcast.com. We are going to put up a post there with some of your penalty miss examples on it, because there were so many in this week, we thought we had to highlight them. So one of our guys is going to put a post up there so you can see them in all their joy. If you didn't get a mention on this week's Twitter topic of the week, you may get a mention on our website, so do check it out. Topic three, quick one to round things off. I've already teased him already and mentioned it's coming. Jason Puncheon's epic miss for Crystal Palace at the weekend. Poor thing. He must absolutely have wanted the ground to swallow him up. So give me two footballing examples, club player, manager or authority, that would have wanted the ground to swallow them up. And one example, one personal example, there's nothing like asking the ladies at the Offside Rule Pod to offer up a bit of personal humiliation as well, is there? What was your ground swallowing moment in football? Lisa, I'll start with you.
Okay, my first one has to be the infamous Shay Given incident. I'm sure most people are familiar with what happened. But for those that aren't, in November 1997, Shay Given naively rolled the ball in front of him following a routine catch, unaware that Coventry City striker Dion Dublin was lurking behind him off the pitch. Dublin simply ran back onto the pitch before knocking it into the empty net. And for that, Shay Given will always be known as the only Irishman that has no idea where Dublin is.
Oh,
okay, my second has to go to Harry Redknapp, which was quite recent, on 29th of December. He obviously hadn't done his homework ahead of their home fixture against Watford. Having forgotten the Hornets had appointed a new coach only 11 days earlier, heading to the dugout pre-match, he strolled straight past Giuseppe Cennino and shook the hand of one of the coaching staff. Oops. It took one of the officials to point out the error of his ways, and he soon headed back and apologised.
Oh. Hayley, two cringeworthy moments from you before we look at all our personal ones. That's a little treat for the end of the podcast. You can just revel in our humiliation.
Because I quite often big up a couple of teams that I am fond of, being Accrington Stanley, or my adopted team, exactly. Middlesbrough, my hometown team, and of course Manchester United, because they are a big team. You all hate the fact that I am pro-Manchester United, so I'm going to give you a couple of embarrassing stories that go kind of against me and Manchester United. And one for, what about Cristiano Ronaldo winning the Ballon d'Or? Well, guess what? When he started out at Manchester United, he was all about tricks and his silky skills and his stepovers. He was in the bid to become the next Ronaldinho. There was a very, very funny clip that we will post on the Offside Rule Pod. And once you have listened to this, you can go on and have a little look. And it's Cristiano Ronaldo with an epic fail. He tried a clever little step over, little back heel, cross it. It was very, very clever. But unlike the true Cristiano Ronaldo style, where he's so slick and, you know, now, it doesn't quite work. Not only does he not manage to kind of get the ball to his feet at his last touch, he falls over the ball and actually falls to the ground. Not a dive like we have seen him do, but he actually trips himself up and he gets up and you can see he does have a bit of a laugh on his face. He does take the mick out of himself and he laughs. So that's absolutely fine. It wasn't a crucial thing that led to a goal or anything like that. But it is quite funny to see a player when he did used to showboat and he was just embarrassing when he'd go for all this. You can showboat now because he is the world's greatest player, of course, isn't he? But this is when it didn't actually pay off. Another one to mention was that Fernando Torres missing that open goal. Do you remember back in 2011 when Vyas Boas said even the world's greatest players miss goals like that? He's had a terrible time going to Chelsea and just not quite working out for him. And it was a completely open goal. He got on a great run. I think United were 3-1 up at the time. It was a chance to go 3-2. He just rounds David De Gea. Would have been so simple, and he shoots, I think it was left of goal, completely off target, and that was embarrassing to say the least.
Okay, well, I have singled out, so it's a bit of a cheap shot from me, really. Joe Kinnear. Let's just remind ourselves that Newcastle fans were none too happy with his appointment. They questioned it left, right and centre. So what does Joe Kinnear decide to do? He decides to phone up TalkSport and set the record straight even. How did he do that? Well, he did that by making a right old mess of most of the players' names, actually. Got a lot of the players wrong. The gaffes included calling Hatim Ben Arthur Ben Afri and Ben Arf. Shola Amiobi became Aminobi or Aminobi. And Johan Kabai was Johan Kebab. Epic fail there by Joe Kinnear. It did nothing to win over the fans. In fact, it did the reverse. It did even more to increase the criticism against him. Oh, and Derek Lambias managed to call him Derek Lambeezy. Easy mistake, right? Sir Alex Ferguson actually made a bit of a boob, according to this little bit of highbrow journalism that I've come across. Bebe move to United. Bit of a disastrous move all round, really. Bebe said on his relationship with Sir Alex Ferguson that Fergie had told Bebe to cut his hair. I mean, he's quite an old school manager, Fergie, bit like Allardyce, actually. Players have to have clean shoes, polished shoes whenever they turn up for a game, suited and booted. Hair needs to be cut and kept respectable. He told me to cut my hair, Bebe said. Said it would look better, so I cut it the same day. In the next training session, he didn't recognise me. I went past him many times and he didn't know me. Epic fail, Sir Alex Ferguson, for not recognising your own player after he'd done exactly as you told him to.
Do you think that's one of the reasons he left? Because he wouldn't have been able to handle Marouane Fellaini and his hair. It's like, I can't handle it. I'm going to have to go if we sign this kid.
Lisa, we'd like one of your own personal humiliations, please.
Okay, my embarrassing moment was probably back in 2012, a little trip to Wembley to watch Spurs take on Chelsea in the FA Cup semi-final with current score at 1-1, thanks to Bale, who cancelled out Drogba's opener. The infamous incident that was the ghost goal by Juan Mata. Obviously, I was furious, and as was kind of most people around me. No one knew whether it had crossed the line or not. And then suddenly it's confirmed by a text message by my dad. So I decided to stand up with my phone in the air, screeching as loud as I could to everybody that, in fact, it wasn't a goal. Everyone looked at me like I was some crazy lady. Why I needed to put my phone in the air, I do not know. Hasten to add, I sat back down and we went on to lose 5-1. So really, it wasn't such a big deal, but it was just very embarrassing. Obviously, I kind of felt like I was breaking news to everybody that, in fact, it didn't cross the line, but... There we go.
My one's not necessarily football related, but it's so hideous that I think I'll mention it. I was interviewing a big cycling personality not that long ago, actually, probably about 6 or 7 months ago. He was waiting for me in a little breakout area here at Sky. I went off to the loo, came back, and he looked at me, and I looked down, and I'd realised that I'd come out with my dress tucked in my knickers. Very professional, I know. He looked at me, I looked down and went... I've just left my phone in the toilet, made a quick exit for the toilet, amended the dress error and came back out again. Didn't mention it. Oh, no. Oh, it's hideous.
But that was the highlight of his week. Oh, dear. God, I've got loads. I've done loads of embarrassing. One thing I'd completely forgot about until recently when somebody actually brought it up. Working for Manchester United Television, I'd gone to the ground, used to work on Champions League nights. So we'd get there around about lunchtime to prepare. Wouldn't be too many people around. Get steadily busier. You'd get in, get parked. I would be doing either presenting from a studio or sometimes pitch side and then doing the mix zone afterwards where you interview the players. So there's one particular occasion I had a suit on, nice suit, white shirt, had a big puffer jacket over the top. It was a Christmas, it was a December fixture before Christmas. It was also just a few days before my birthday. So I had gone and had a pedicure in the morning. Knew where I was, put my flip-flops on. Wait, there was no such thing as gel and shellac at this point. This was a few years ago before that was discovered. Boys, if you're listening, over your head. Yeah. Anyway, I had my toes painted. Drove in, fine. Opened up the boot when I got to the ground. Took my bag out, went in, toes had dried. Went to put my socks on and some nice shoes. Shoes weren't there. Boots weren't there. Thought, oh, I must have UGG boots in my car. I must have something to put on my feet. Nothing. I didn't have any shoes. This was a couple hours before kickoff. There was no way I was getting in or out of Old Trafford to get home to go and pick something up. I had to do post-match interviews in flip-flops and a suit in December when it was freezing. So that's just one little embarrassing story.
I'm sure we'll have many more to come in the weeks and episodes ahead on the Offside Rule podcast. Let's head over to our foreign correspondent for this week and hear all things Syria. Mina Rizzuki is on standby. Mina.
Hello and welcome to the Serie A roundup. And I can tell you that Milan have finally sacked coach Massimiliano Allegri, the man who's been clinging on to his job for the best part of 2 years. The humiliation of watching Sassuolo's teenage striker score 4 against the mighty Milan giants was simply too much to bear for the directors, and Allegri was finally shown the door. Sassuolo are the newly promoted side and one that has never played top-flight football before. They hail from a teeny tiny town with a population of 41,000. Yet they made history when they qualified for Serie A last season, playing an attractive brand of football under Eusebio Di Francesco. This season they struggled for points and their coach was under pressure. That is until Milan came to town. Incidentally, Sassuolo president Giorgio Squinzi is a diehard Milanista who once insisted he'd cheer them on even if they were playing his own club. Oh, how he must have wept as his beautifully crafted side destroyed the Giants to win 4-3. Clarence Seedorf is now the man in charge in Milan, and whilst he may not have the coaching experience necessary, he's famous for his understanding of the sport. The team might just start winning again. Meanwhile, over in Turin, Juventus broke a record by managing 11 consecutive victories, conceding only 2 goals in the process. It's almost boring how brilliant they are at this domestic football stuff. Roma are still plugging away, collecting the wins, even if it's unlikely they can overcome the old lady in the table, whilst Inter have simply forgotten how to win. 2 defeats and then a draw? Is coach Walter Mazzarri really all that? Or should they have stuck with Andrea Stramaccioni just that bit longer? That's all for now. Ciao!
That's it for this week's Offside Rule podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on, Lisa. Thank you very much for sharing your football knowledge with us. And fresh from the dance off too, I can confirm there may or may not be a bean stuck to the base of her boot. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Hayley, thank you once again as well, and we'll see you next week.
Yes, thank you.
Don't forget, we're available to download and to listen to every Thursday via Audioboo and iTunes. You can find us on Twitter. Give us a follow at Offside Rule Pod. Our Facebook page, The Offside Rule, give us a like. And of course, our fabulous website with new branding as well. It looks ever so sleek. OffsideRulePodcast.com. Take care and we'll see you next week.
The Female Take on Football.